according to the police officer I spoke to, they went through a list of questions in order to ascertain whether or not she was safe and determined that she was okay to be on her own on the streets of Victoria, barefoot in November, and they left her there. That was the last time anyone ever saw her.
You are listening to Emma Filipov is Missing, an ongoing series by the Nighttime Podcast.
Unlike any story I've prepared, the unexplained disappearance of Emma Filipov has stuck with me. I've tried to figure out why, and I've really narrowed it down to three reasons. It's in part due to the mystifying details of her last known day. It's certainly a lingering symptom of the emotion I felt when speaking to her mother, Shelley. And I know it has a lot to do with my belief that Emma's case has a real potential to be solved. Now, for listeners who've been following Emma's story, or for those of you who are choosing to proceed regardless, I'll get you up to speed with this brief summary. Emma Filipov was last seen standing shoeless on a busy intersection in Victoria, British Columbia, on a cold night in November of 2012. The last people to speak with her were two Victoria police officers who were responding to a call from an acquaintance of Emma's who reported her being in distress, possibly due to a mental health crisis. On Emma's last known day, she seemed to be planning something. Between two separate visits, she was captured on a 7-Eleven convenience store's security camera, purchasing a prepaid cell phone and a prepaid credit card. In both of these videos, she also exhibited odd, maybe paranoid behavior. Since Emma's disappearance, there's been very little in the way of leads or developments, but despite that, the story recently made its way back to the national news for reasons no one would have expected. In March of 2016, the press would learn that Emma's mother, in past Nighttime Podcast guest, Shelley Filipov, had been charged with a series of offenses related to cocaine trafficking and illegal firearm possession. In this follow-up episode, I've invited Shelley back to address the charges against her and to help me better understand some of the details of this disappearance that still has me dumbfounded as to what may have happened. After my interview with Shelley, we'll hear an extended conversation with my friends and past guests of the show, Tim and Lance, from the Missing Maura Murray podcast. In that conversation, we'll discuss Emma's case and its many twists, turns, and possible outcomes. I'll get started now with my recent interview with Shelley Filipov. I just wanted to ask, first of all, if there's been any new developments in the search for Emma since we last spoke.
Unfortunately, no. There has been nothing new. We still get tips. We still get sightings. Unfortunately, occasionally, the tip that we'll get will say, "I think I might have seen your daughter in Edmonton in 2015." Well, that may be or may not be, but that's of no use. If we can't respond to the tip immediately, then that tip isn't really much use to us. And because I'm in Ontario, if someone feels that they have seen Emma, they need to get a hold of the local police ASAP and get them to look into it. Because again, I'm in Ontario. I can't just be in Edmonton, you know, in a split second, or in Vancouver or wherever the sighting's been. So it's very important that people realize that to contact me a year later and say, "I think I might have seen your daughter," even though people mean well, and it's not a lack of appreciation on my part by any means, but it doesn't really help us narrow down where she might be.
These tips that you're talking about, I'm assuming a lot of these are coming through your Facebook group?
Yes, they do primarily come through my Facebook. I have people that email me. And I have people that private Facebook message me. But most of them appear on the Help Find Emma Filipov page, Facebook page.
It must just be frustrating for you to receive a tip where, you know, I believe 8 to 10 to 12 months ago I may have seen her, that it's just must be so vague to act on.
Well, it's impossible to act on. And the page, the Help Emma Filipov Facebook page is receiving more and more views and more likes all the time. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but certainly people have not forgotten her, and there seem to be more and more people interested in her case.
One reason that the story's been in the news recently, and I have to bring this up, it's an unexpected reason, that reason being the criminal allegations against yourself and another Filipov family member. Now, given that these charges are still pending, can you comment on your current legal situation as well as how this situation's impacting your search for Emma?
Yes, I can. There are two or three points that I would like to make. The first point that I would like to make are the charges. Nothing's moved ahead. My lawyer still does not have disclosure, so we have no idea what the legal community thinks they have against me. And I will tell you, I will be very frank with what took place. My son, my older son, Matthew, who's 28, had been using my house as a stash house for cocaine. And I was unaware of it, and the police apparently had been tracking him for some time. And because it's my house but not his address, they felt that I must in some way be involved, therefore charged me. I was in no way aware of what Matthew was doing. It goes without saying that Matthew didn't announce to me, his mother, what he was up to. And one of the points that people have made and have said, well, how could you not know what's going on in your house? Well, you know, Matthew, my children come and go as they please from my home. I would not suspect Matthew of such an activity, therefore I wouldn't be monitoring his behavior while he was visiting. And the other thing is, as well, in my emotional state, I spent a lot of time in my own world, so I wouldn't have been tracking his comings and goings. So it is my hope that all charges will be dropped, as none of them are applicable. And that's what I'm waiting for, is to hear from the court system. The second point I would like to make, and the most salient one, is that I was very hurt. I was angered, very upset over the fact that a number of people, not people that know me, anyone that knows me has been extremely supportive. I have an extremely supportive community. People that know me know that these are false accusations. But a number of people chose Emma's Facebook page to attack me, to make negative comments in regards to the charges against me. That page is intended for Emma and Emma only. It is to help in the search for Emma. It has nothing to do with me. So that is the most salient point that I would like to make. It was very hurtful. It was very hurtful. And then, you know, how Facebook goes, and then people respond, and then there'd be a debate about whether the charges could be real. Maybe this is why Emma is actually missing. And it just went on and on. And I chose not to delete them because I really do believe in free speech, but I also chose not to comment. I have chosen not to comment on any of these. Needless to say, now they've subsided. It seems that the interest has shifted away from me.
And how has this all gotten in the way of your search for Emma? I'm just assuming that if you're going to do interviews or meet with anybody, this is going to be coming up. How are you dealing with that?
It upsets me that the focus will turn to that, because I am me, and that's an incident that is completely separate from my daughter's case. Emma is missing. Emma is lost. My activities, whether true or not, have absolutely no bearing on the case. And people get lost, much less so now. Now the interest has waned, but people were getting lost in my case as opposed to continuing to focus on Emma. So that has been difficult. And as I said, a number of people use Emma's page to vent and to attack me and do a little character assassination and that kind of thing. So that's been difficult to deal with. Not only the hurtful comments, but the fact that they're taking time and space from Emma's page, which is intended to help me find Emma, not have people come after me.
I can't even imagine how that myself feel. And I know the type of comments you're mentioning, because when this all happened, that was one of the first places I went to find out what was going on. And so I know exactly what you're referring to. So from there, I'll change the topic unless there's anything else you want to say about that.
I would like the cases to be considered separately, as one has nothing to do with the other. Unfortunately, now when you Google Emma Filipoff, very quickly one of the things that comes up is mother of missing woman Emma Filipoff charged with blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's taking away from what's the most important thing, and the most important thing is that we find Emma.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Now, one question that I was hoping you could answer, and I'm going to move on now to discussing specifics of Emma's case. So one thing that's been puzzling me is what I've heard about her possible activity on a cell phone. So initially, before on the day she was last seen, I understood that she purchased what I thought was her first ever cell phone, which I believe was like a prepaid cell phone. But I've learned since then that some people believe in some of the surveillance footage seen in the days leading up to her disappearance. Some people believe that she was using a cell phone, seen texting, I think, in the doorway to a library for an extended period. Can you talk about this and why the speculation that she may have had another cell phone?
Well, the footage is actually from the YMCA footage. And I've looked at it over and over again. And I personally do not make out a cell phone. I do not see anything that looks as though she is using a cell phone. She's far more intent on watching out the door, peeking out the door, going in and out of the door, walking down the hallway of the YMCA. At some point, she does have something in her hand, and she is looking at it, but it certainly didn't strike me as a cell phone, and I've looked at the footage quite extensively.
I can imagine.
It's not to say that it isn't one, but I think it would take an expert in videography to be able to focus in on that to see if it is, in fact, a cell phone. Personally, I don't think it is.
And I don't know if it has gone this far, but are you aware if like her name and her information was searched with like, you know, the major cell phone providers to see if maybe there was any accounts that she had open?
That would be something that the police would hopefully have done. I was never given a report with regards to that, so I can't really speak to that.
Okay. Speaking of the police, I'll move on to one other thing that's been puzzling me, and that's the Victoria Police Department's handling of both their actions that night in speaking with Emma and leaving her on the side of the road, but also with their handling of the evidence related to Emma. Now, the night of her disappearance, we all know her last activity was a roughly 45-minute conversation between herself and two officers. I've recently learned about the journey, it seems, that you've gone through to try to obtain transcripts of the conversation, and I believe up to this point you've been unsuccessful. Can you just describe these transcripts you're trying to get on this conversation with the police, as well as what you've gone through to try to get them?
Well, I applied for a Freedom of Information Act and was denied. The reason given by the Victoria Police Department is that if this were ever to turn into a criminal case, any conversation that was held between those two police officers and Emma would be inadmissible if I had been privy to those. On the other hand, they do not feel that there has been any foul play. So I feel that I would be best, one of the best ones to judge the content of that conversation. I might have been able to glean something that Emma said or something that Emma didn't say that might have given me a clue, because I know her. But no, they will not. They will not allow me to see those transcripts. As I said, I applied for Freedom of Information Act and was denied.
You know, I'm a layman with this, but I wouldn't think if the police stopped someone on the road that they would, and speak to them, that they would maintain a transcript. Would the transcript be like, in my mind, I'm picturing like all the dialogue that they spoke about. Is that what you're expecting these documents to contain, or would it be just like a short police report, or do you even know what would be in this report?
I have no idea. My guess is that it wasn't taped, that they did not record the conversation, so I would think that it would just be notes in a notebook and then transcripts made once the officers returned to the office. Again, the content is elusive. I have not been able to find out what took place. The police gave me a rough idea of how the conversation went. You know, they asked her if she was all right. They asked if she was suicidal. They asked her if she had eaten. They asked her if she had a place to stay. They did tell me that those were some of the questions that the police officers asked. I feel very strongly about the police dropping the ball that night. If anything, when you ask someone who seems in some kind of perilous situation, who seems unbalanced, if you do, in fact, ask them if they plan on committing suicide, there's no guarantee that they're going to admit to it. So her saying no, to me, would certainly not have calmed my concerns as a person. And the other thing is that she claimed that she had a place to stay, which in fact she did, at the Sandy Merriman shelter. She had a bed for the night. Why those police officers didn't say, well, hop in the back seat of the car, Emma, of the patrol car, and we will drive you to your location where you're going to stay. And that way they could have ascertained that she did in fact have a place to stay. That to me would have been standard procedure rather than leaving her shivering barefoot on the corner of the street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in my mind, asking the questions about her mental health and her intentions and whatnot that night, it seems to me, again, I'm a layman, but it would seem like asking those questions of someone that appears to be in trauma in some way, it almost is just almost like you're building your own excuse. Like if I could tell you're in a really bad case or in a really bad state and I asked you those questions, I, like you said, I wouldn't expect you to give me a truthful answer. And then,
or a direct answer, you know, or even a direct one.
Yeah, and then to accept that at face value and walk away, it I just can't imagine how you must feel.
It broke my heart, but it angered me, and it still angers me to this day, especially in terms of her having a place to stay. I mean, I have heard of many instances where police have spoken to people and have asked them if they've had a place to stay, and they've insisted on taking that person to the place that they claim they can stay. I mean, that to me would have been standard protocol. Hop in the back of the patrol car, Emma. Tell me where you're going. We will drive you there. We will take you in, and we will make sure that this, in fact, is a place for you to stay tonight. Seems to me that would be standard procedure. To leave somebody on the street, whether you felt that she was mentally or emotionally impaired, clearly she was not in her right mind, and I think it's unforgivable that they just left her there.
With the Victoria Police Department's investigation, does it appear to you that they're investigating Emma's disappearance as a simple runaway, as a typical runaway, or do you believe they're investigating the possibility of foul play?
Well, I think initially they felt that she was just gone for a couple of days, either partying or spending time with friends. Not necessarily a runaway, because of her age, 26. It's not as likely to be a case of a runaway. But they were fairly adamant in saying that they didn't feel that there was any foul play. And that has concerned me all along because I'm not sure what they're basing that on. We don't think there's been foul play. Well, how do they know? We don't know that Emma's alive. So how do we know that she hasn't been someone's prey? Not that I think that they should only consider foul play, but I think after a certain number of days, they should have started looking a little more closely at that aspect.
From there, I wanted to ask about the man who was seen with the torn up poster in the store in Vancouver, the squished up poster. Has there been any activity towards tracking him down?
Just having it show up on the Facebook page over and over again, and we haven't posters. I'm a little worried about the legality of postering someone, you know, putting up their posters saying, looking for this man or this man is wanted in connection. So we were a little concerned about that.
The next thing that And this seems to be a bit of a mystery to me, is the story of Julian and his relationship with Emma. Now, I'll tell you what I understand about it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that Julian was a young man that was an acquaintance of Emma's at her when she lived with you in Perth. They had, I won't say a relationship, but they were involved for a short period of time in some way. She from then moved from Perth, leaving him behind, but he continued to make romantic advances, I believe, exhibiting what has been defined to be stalking behavior, I believe, in trying to contact yourself and Emma's father. And then, unbeknownst to Emma, he arrived in Victoria, running into her in the street in what seems to me to be an odd coincidence. I understand he was also polygraphed by police, but was cleared as a suspect. Can you just describe the history of Emma and Julian and what your thoughts are on Julian?
Well, I wish I could describe the history. My husband and I were separated at the time, and Emma was living with her dad. So, and I live about 20 minutes from her dad. So I did not have an opportunity to see Emma and Julian interact at all. So all I have is what my husband has told me and what I surmised after the fact once I met him in Victoria. I do know that the word stalker was the word that was used by him. I never used that word in terms of Julian. To my knowledge, Emma didn't necessarily use that word. He sent an email to my ex-husband, and he referred to himself as stalking, as having stalked Emma, and he wanted to apologize. I don't think it was an actual relationship. Perhaps it was more of a relationship in Julian's mind than in Emma's. And at one point, she had asked him to stop calling and stop coming by the house, but he persisted, and Emma's dad had to speak to him, and then he would phone quite often and ask for Emma, and again, Emma's dad would have to intervene and say, Emma doesn't want to speak with you. The fact that he turned up in Victoria is a very, very interesting coincidence. I'm not a big believer in coincidence, so And I personally questioned him because he joined the search team once he tracked me down, which I also found a little bit odd. I was in the library on one of the computers watching the front door to see if Emma would be coming in, and noticed this young man staring at me. So I went over and asked if I could help him, and he introduced himself, and I asked him how he knew me, and he said, well, I recognize you from your Facebook pictures. And I found that a little odd. I would be hard-pressed to pick out a complete stranger out of a group of people. Everybody, the computers were full. I would find that a little bit odd and difficult. So anyways, so he joined us. He joined the team, and I did at one point ask him. I said, don't you think that's a bit of a coincidence, Julian, that Emma would come to Victoria and then shortly after you would be here? And he said, oh, no, it isn't a coincidence at all. It is a coincidence. I had no idea Emma was going to Victoria. I find that hard to believe. Although Emma flew to Victoria because her dad and I didn't want her taking a bus, we just felt it wasn't safe. So we got her an airline ticket. She walked around with her bus ticket for Victoria in her back pocket from the moment she purchased it. I think Julian knew that she was going to Victoria. I don't have proof of that. He's denied it. I've let it go because I don't see any point in pursuing it at this point. But I think he knew. I think he knew she was going to Victoria. As I said, I don't believe in coincidences.
Mm-hmm. And that, it, like you said, is a pretty big coincidence.
It's a huge coincidence. Canada is a pretty big place.
Yes, it is. Now, in researching Emma's story again since my last episode, one thing that I've learned about that just changes some of my point of view on it is some of her living arrangements before her time in the women's shelter, or perhaps even during the same time as she was staying in the women's shelter. And it sounded to me as in some ways she was on her way to living a sort of a transient lifestyle. For example, I've heard of her living for a time, I believe on a friend's boat, as well as in some sort of a treehouse. Can you talk about what you found out about Emma's time in Victoria before her disappearance?
Yes. I mean, it took me a while to track down the different places that she stayed, but once I found out that she was staying at a woman's shelter, I knew that something was desperately wrong. She hadn't led us to believe one thing or another. She just said she was staying with a friend, and in fact, we discovered that she had stayed with a couple of friends, three different friends on three different occasions for a period of time. So, again, not being aware of any problems, Emma was very good at camouflaging problems or any emotional upset. She kept very close to her heart. So it wasn't until I was actually in Victoria and started looking around to find friends and people that knew her, acquaintances and so on. And that's when I discovered that she stayed on two different boats and had stayed with three different friends.
Okay.
At different times.
And, you know,
it came across as Emma living a transient life. Yes, it did.
And do you believe, like, would this have been typical of her, or do you think this was perhaps the result of deteriorating mental health that would have led to this sort of lifestyle?
That's a very difficult question, Jordan. Emma left home when she was about 18 to go to school and pursue her education and do some traveling. So, you know, once you stop seeing your children every day, it becomes harder and harder to really know who they're becoming. So whether Emma had a penchant for a transient life, I can't really say. She certainly gave us no indication of that. I mean, she stayed with us, you know, through school, and she stayed with her dad when she came to visit. There was nothing. She went to college. She had an apartment. There was nothing to indicate to us that she was interested in the transient life. It wasn't until I got to Victoria that I realized that she was definitely leaning that way.
And the reason I ask those questions is I know some people believe that there's the potential that she could be now living a transient life on the streets. Do you have any reason to believe that she may have been involved in drugs or the drug trade or anything that would have led her this way, with the exception of perhaps a deteriorating mental health?
I found nothing to indicate drug use in her journals, and the people I spoke to said that that she rarely drank, that she had given up smoking cigarettes, definitely they said Emma was not involved in drugs. That's not to say that that didn't change over time, but the time leading up to her disappearance, I couldn't find anyone to support the idea that she had turned to drugs of any sort. So I came to the conclusion that it was a mental issue that was at play here.
And when we spoke last, the primary area that you seem to be focusing the majority of your search efforts was in Vancouver. Is that still the case, or has that changed in any way?
Well, to be honest, Jordan, I'm at a loss. I'm at a total loss. When I went to Vancouver the couple of times that I went, I thought that it was probably the most reasonable place for her to go. Very easy access from Victoria. If she was, in fact, living a transient life, there's a huge transient population in Vancouver in the Lower East Side. So had she chosen that lifestyle, it made sense that she would go to Vancouver, that she would be in Vancouver. I based that only on my own summation. I have no solid evidence to indicate that she's in Vancouver, none whatsoever.
At this point, we're just over 3.5 years since Emma was last seen, and you've tried so many different things and looked in so many different directions to track her down. What comes next? What's your next step?
Oh, another good question, Jordan. I'm not sure. To be honest, I'm not sure. I'm at a loss. I've run out of ideas. I paid to have a billboard put up in Victoria and in different places, and then I think the other places, maybe Comox, and then one in Duncan, huge lit up the billboard showing Emma with a number to contact. That resulted in nothing. I don't think a single, unless tips came into the police, no tip came to me after that. Perhaps the police were given a couple of tips. Perhaps people called the police, but no one contacted me based on those billboards. So to be very honest, as heartbreaking as it is, I really don't know where else to turn.
Was there ever a time when you did have an obvious next step? Like I can imagine now, just like you just answered, it's hard to picture what to do next. Was that always the case? Like, do you feel like you're checking off things on a list, basically, of options, or has it always been just blindly walking through it?
No. I always had a next step. It's certainly something that has kept me going. I always had a next step, whether it was media or postering or pursuing CBC, the Fifth Estate, for a documentary. But no, I've always had a next step. I've run out of ideas. To be perfectly honest, Jordan, I've run out of ideas. I don't know where to turn. This is a good next step, talking to you. This is definitely a good next step. I've struggled to find reasons to have them to recreate interest in the case for the media, but there's nothing to catch their eye.
Mm-hmm. I just, as a parent myself, I can't even imagine how it must feel. And then when I first read the news with yourself in the news recently, like we talked about earlier, I think a tear ran down my cheek, thinking, is there anything else that could happen to this poor woman and her family?
Well, I feel like this is a starstruck family now. It's been very, very difficult. And as I said, the fact that the focus shifted from Emma to me has been heartbreaking. Not only because I am innocent of the charges, that is somewhat irrelevant. And I don't really think that should be a bigger concern to the general public than the fact that my daughter is missing. I just don't think that's the way it should go. But people love stories. People love to hear bad news.
This episode, I hope to reach as many people as possible. Now, with anyone who listens to this that may have information or a willingness to help or who just wants to learn more about the case, how can they reach you and find out more about Emma's story?
Well, they can private message me on Facebook. I'm very easy to find. I'm the only Shelley Philipoff on there. They can email me at philipoff@hotmail.com. And I never, Jordan, I never tire from hearing from people, whether they're calling to be supportive or to give me suggestions as to what my next step could be. I never tire of hearing from the public that's been so supportive.
Our next guests, Tim and Lance, are well known for their coverage of the Maura Murray disappearance on their widely successful podcast, soon-to-be documentary film, Missing Maura Murray. When I turned to them for advice on how to best approach this follow-up story, they offered to review Emma's case, and from there, they agreed to join in the discussion with me. So before I invited you both to talk to me about the case, were you aware of Emma Filipov's disappearance?
I was not. I learned of her disappearance through your show after you had contacted us the first time. I went back and listened to all of them, and that was obviously the second one that you did.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of the disappearance either. And when I read the name, at first I thought I might have been. And then I was trying really hard when I was looking at the pictures to make the connection. But no, I was not familiar with that case.
In Canada, this is a pretty major case. CBC did a documentary on it, Finding Emma. And what's funny, when I first heard about your show, immediately where my head went was like, wow, that Maura Murray's case sounds so much like Emma Filipov's. I'll have to check out the show. So it's just funny how that works.
They definitely are similar cases for a lot of reasons. I said that a lot kind of listening. It was like, this is the Canadian Maura, and obviously I know the Maura story first and better. So yeah, that was where my head went immediately.
Well, I just not doing this to cause any scripted drama or scripted conflict, but that was the first thing that I thought. And then the more I looked into it and when I watched the Fifth Estate's production of Finding Emma, it was like Maura. And the more I started watching it, the more it really started to deviate from anything that I related to Maura Murray.
The main things that I found similar between the two was, for one, and maybe Emma's case painted my perception of Maura's, but the elements of mental health and mental illness. When I listen to your show and read about Maura's case, I'm often thinking, could she possibly have been suffering a mental illness, and could that explain her odd behavior in the days leading up to it? That's one thing I thought they had in common. The other being, the day Emma disappeared, she was up to something. She was planning to either go somewhere or do something, because she had bought a prepaid cell phone, prepaid credit card on the day she disappeared, just as Maura planned, you know, was planning something. So those are kind of the things I was looking at when I was thinking of the similarities.
Those are pretty similar circumstances. They were both planning on something. They both were planning on some sort of getaway, we'll say, a journey or whatever. But the mental illness part of it, I think, was way more obvious in the Emma case. Mm-hmm. When I was watching the CBC documentary, I was starting to almost feel this really like guilty sense of jealousy that you have this diary that she's writing in, and you have access to the surveillance. Any sort of security video is already out there. This happened in 2012, right?
Exactly. November of 2012.
Yeah, you have access. All of the footage is out there. The family's cooperating. And the diary, to me, and I guess I'm making two points at the same time here, the diary is what really struck me as something that was suggesting some sort of something beyond an adolescent angst. There was paranoia.
Well, she was an artist, no question about that. Some of her poetry I thought was really interesting and great. Even the one that has been referred to as a suicide note. At first glance, you say, oh, yeah, that's a suicide note. But I actually don't think it necessary. I actually don't think it is a suicide note, even though she says this is coming from dead Emma, right? I just think she was consumed with creativity. And I know her dad was an artist. The similarities with the Maura case are staggering, because there are still three possible outcomes: suicide, murder, or
kind of running away. With Emma's, there's some thought that she may have left her life to live a transient life, living on the street somewhere, maybe as a result of her mental illness.
Yeah, I mean I guess her mom says she believes she was mentally ill. So I would start there and take her word for it absolutely that she was probably suffering from some kind of manic episode, some kind of psychotic break. But at the same time, I don't think you can discount abduction or murder or runaway for that matter. But that guy Julian, I think, really needs to be looked at more. And I know he was in the documentary, the Finding Emma documentary, but and he was very, very brave to do that interview. But it's very, very strange wording in his email to Emma's dad, saying he used the word stock. No one else used the word stocked. It's fascinating to me. It maybe it's a little bit too much like in the movies. Like we get this a lot. Like people say, oh, John Smith, you guys got to watch him. He's like a Hannibal Lecter type. He gets close to you. And, you know, to say that Julian is that guy, he's putting himself out there. It's far-fetched in general because the percentages of that are very, very slim. But that guy needs to be looked into more.
But he was looked into and he passed a polygraph test, right?
So was.
No. I agree. Yeah, exactly. Because I think even passing that polygraph test still isn't enough to convince me that it was just a coincidence he ended up in the same town as her. How long was that after?
I don't know exactly how long, but it was a short amount of time. I think months is what we're looking at.
I guess it doesn't really matter because you're looking at an entire country where she could have gone. It's pretty clear that, I mean, unless it is a giant coincidence, I don't know what you believe, but it's pretty clear to me that he somehow connected everything because he ends up quote unquote randomly bumping into Shelley later on
and gets involved in the search, which to me
gets involved in the search.
When I listened to that part, I didn't know that happened. When I asked her the question in that conversation, that sent shivers down my spine. I was just like, that is really weird.
Right. When she's talking about how she's sitting there and she looks over and someone's staring at her and she actually had to make the move to talk to him as opposed to him walking over to her and saying, are you Emma's mother?
And yet he recognized her out of the crowd.
And he said he recognized her.
From Facebook photos, I think is what she had said.
I mean, that's and when I saw him on camera and he said, nope, that's an absolute coincidence. And everyone else is saying, I don't believe in coincidences, especially when it's a missing person, a missing attractive female. Who do you always go to first?
Yeah, the boyfriend or
boyfriend of the husband.
Yeah. But I will say that coincidences are a thing. As looking into this Maura Murray case, we experience coincidences maybe as bizarre as that, where we have experienced them. And no matter what the truth is with Maura, there are coincidences in there that you're like, well, fuck, that didn't lead anywhere.
Like,
you know,
the rag and the tailpipe. What's up with that?
Yes. Yeah, something. But just in investigating it, you know, there are tons of little coincidences. You can ask John Smith about that, actually. He'd tell you a lot about that. But so I know that that's possible. But he seems like, I mean,
he called himself a stalker.
Yeah.
Just like Maura's case, what are the chances that the timing would be this tight? Because Shelley was arriving by plane 3 hours after she was last seen. Something was going on that day that led Emma to get the credit card, the cell phone. The police were called because she was standing on a busy intersection with her shoes in her hand in the middle of a cold November night. What are the chances that that would be the night that somebody abducts her or does something? It just, she'd be vulnerable that night, but it just seems weird that this much is going on and then lightning strikes.
Then a random lightning strike.
It does, but as we learned about victimology in our episode with Marley Davis, Emma was the perfect victim that night. The perfect victim. Shoeless, potentially going through a psychotic break at that moment. The way she behaved in the 7-Eleven, I don't think you can say for certain that she wasn't actually running from somebody based on that video footage.
I was thinking about this because that was my first impression that she's and the one of her going in and out of the Y like six times.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, she's running from somebody. Now, unless there's something in her diary that law enforcement hasn't given to the family or made public, because it seems like they made a lot of that public, her diary public. There's no one specific mentioned in that. She wrote so often in that diary, you'd think that there would be a mention of, for example, Julian won't leave me alone or something. Mm-hmm. But that's not out there. But yet we have these videos of her clearly looking out, as if she's being followed or as if she's being shadowed, chased or stalked. And there's no mention of a name anywhere in these diaries that she so often writes in. So that's why I'm leading more towards either like a complete psychotic paranoid breakdown or some sort of drug use.
Emma was bursting with creativity. And so I think that some of those diaries may have been about Julian, but not named him.
Yeah, and it's all that writing, it's creative writing, journal, poetry, kind of all blended together. So they may as well have just been paintings that people are interpreting, because it was the wording and the language was so vague. Yeah. Now, let's get to some of the main points Shelley made during the interview we had just listened to. First thing that has to come up at this point is the charges that Shelley's facing. Although she hasn't been proven guilty or anything, just the timing of this and the fact that this is dumped on top of her and her family in the middle of the search for her daughter, I don't know what to make of it. When you've heard that after, because Tim, you had known about my first episode, when you heard about these charges against Shelley, what were your thoughts?
I think immediately you go to, I hope this isn't what it sounds like. You know, could she have had something to do with Emma's disappearance? So your head does go there naturally, I think.
Yeah, when I first read the article, I was just like at work and my phone was just blowing up with messages and emails and stuff. And it was just as the news was announced. So people who had listened to my show were filling me in. And when I first read it, it sounded bad. But after speaking to Shelley the first time, there was no doubt in my mind that she wasn't a grieving mother searching for her daughter. The fact, to me, my first thought was if she was trying to, you know, if she, let's say she was involved and she was trying to hide it or something, why would she appear on the second episode of a completely unknown podcast to talk to me for an hour and a half? That was my first thought. But when I spoke to her this time and she gave her explanation of what happened with her son, you know, storing stuff in her basement and all that, to me, that absolutely makes sense. My parents had no idea what I was doing in their house. And I had a lot of things in my parents' house that if the police found it, we'd all would have been in some trouble.
So it's a house I'm assuming he's very familiar with. And, you know, when you're in that sort of situation, I am once again assuming that you stash things in a familiar spot where you know familiar hiding spots. You know the places that you can open up. I'm just saying, you can open up a floorboard, you can go into the attic, and you know all the little like nooks that you can stash things in.
What do you have stored in your old family home, Lance?
Well, let's not go there.
Well, but I asked the question.
But when I first heard of it, it was it's funny. Maybe it's because just being a part of the Moore Murray disappearance, I just immediately went to, wow, this family has been pulled apart. This family has been, you know, this family's been pulled apart. And it really it never once occurred to me that there was any connection between, because I know Shelley said that there was, people were accusing, you know, this is why she went missing, it's probably some drug trade. And I can only imagine, and can't even begin to sympathize enough with her, that, you know, the theories and the scenarios that people come up with online and present to her. But it really is, it seems like a broken family. Mm-hmm. And it's heartbreaking.
And this may be a symptom of the broken family. Like, these are just the things that happen when something traumatic happens in the center of
the
family.
Absolutely.
When I spoke to her, my thought both times after I got off the phone with her was just, how can she possibly even talk about this, let alone, you know, lift her head off the pillow in the morning? I can't. Like, and Tim, you can probably relate to this. If something ever happened to my child, I don't know how I could go on for another second after, you know, it happened.
Yeah, it would be really awful. Yeah, I definitely believe Shelley's story, no question about it. It sounds way more likely than what the initial articles sounded like. So I'm happy to hear her on your in your interview, and completely believe her and sympathize with her. Mm-hmm.
I just hope it gets settled quickly, because I just like, if she didn't already have enough to worry about to have that dumped on top of it, it's almost seems cruel.
Yeah.
And she is a really strong person, right? She came right out and she was, you said, I don't know if we're able to talk about this. And she, no, we can talk about it. We can talk about it, because she wanted to put it out there. She wanted, it seemed to me that she wanted to put it out there and say, I have nothing to do with this. This is something that happens in a family, and it's got nothing to do with Emma. And, you know,
And I applaud her for not responding to the trolls that she mentioned on the Facebook page. She didn't respond at all to their points. And I think that's the best way to handle that. She really knocked that one out of the park.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that she can talk about a strong person. She talks about it with composure, like her voice isn't even wavering. I couldn't imagine talking about anything that she speaks about on these calls, and she's direct. She's not humming and hawing. I find it incredible.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, next thing I find odd is the police handling of Emma's disappearance. Not the police handling of her disappearance, but the police handling of Emma the night they spoke to her. Now, they were responding to a call from a guy that had known Emma just from meeting her a few times at the library. He phoned the police after running into her at the busy intersection without her shoes on a cold November night. They approached her, the police, and spoke about 45 minutes. Ultimately, in the end, just leaving her on the side of the road where she's never seen again. The police have never released the details of the transcript or the transcript of that conversation or the details of the conversation, but they did say that they were repeatedly assured by her that she was okay and not at a danger to herself. I guess hindsight's 20/20. She's now missing, and they spoke to her. But to me, if I approach someone who's in a state of trauma or having a breakdown on the side of the road, I don't know how I would deal with it, but I feel like I wouldn't just be saying, you know, are you okay? All right.
I think it's pretty easy to write it off as if they had said, like, okay, see you later. But they probably have a list of things that they have to ask people when they're in that situation. And when I was listening to it again, my first response is, wow, why didn't the police take her to the woman's shelter or take her to a safe, warm place? And then I realized the world we live in today, there are probably so many liabilities that police officers have. They're probably instructed, you cannot take people from the street, because no one can tell what happens in the police car between when you pick them up and to when you deliver them. And these are real things. Like, these are things that police officers have to pay attention to. And maybe it's simply that. Maybe the police officers felt like shit having to leave her there. And, you know, maybe we'll swing by in an hour or a half hour and check on her. And, you know, maybe that was what they were thinking. But I think legally, I think liability-wise, they might not have been in a position to. I remember being, I think I was like 22 or so, and then my car broke down, and police officer pulled up, and I said that I was going to try to figure out what was wrong with it, and I said, can you give me a ride to a phone? And he was like, can't do it. I'm not a taxi service. And he drove away. And I mean, that was a really quick, like, easy, you know, getaway for him, but. I was pissed at first, but when I think about it now, it's like, well, you can't just pick up anybody who's.
Yeah, but she was shoeless.
It doesn't matter. It could be a trap. Like, it's actually liability. This, you know, the police state, the law enforcement might not. He could have gotten suspended for doing that, even if it was all on the up and up.
There's nothing illegal about being shoeless on the side of a road on a cold November night when you're alone and acting strange. But I just feel like everything that happened that day leading up to her disappearance would show that she wasn't in her right mental state. And I can't imagine that they could speak to her for 45 minutes and something not happen that would lead them to say, you know, get in the car and we're going to have to make sure you're okay.
It was a 45-minute conversation?
Yeah, and they've...
Oh, I missed that.
And
okay.
Shelley's been... Yeah, so they spent a lot of time with her, and Shelley's been actively pursuing transcripts of the conversation, be it a recording or even the police report, and have yet to get anything, because I think what she had told me was if it became a criminal investigation, having released that could be a problem.
That actually stood out a lot to me, because there are things that we were thinking about a lot and talking about a lot with the Mora case. You know, why aren't they giving the family information? Why aren't they doing that? And I wouldn't have put things together like I did until I listened to your interview, when she said, if it goes to a criminal, if there's a criminal element to it, and it goes to trial, what they've given to me is completely inadmissible now. and they don't have a case. And that's like, wow, what a kick in the nuts, right?
What I kind of thought of when I listening to this point of it, I was thinking with the case that you're covering with Maura Murray's disappearance, there's the video, the ATM video. Is this not the, you know, the equivalent of that? But I just feel like the mother should be able to, I just feel like if something happened to my child, I should be have access to everything. And I don't see why Shelley can't. But I guess it's on the outside looking in and not knowing what could go wrong. The police probably have dealt with cases where things have fallen apart because they showed compassion to the family. But I just feel like Shelley should know what happened.
They should really at least show Shelley the transcripts, very much like the ATM video, which we heard some movement on lately, but I probably shouldn't say any more than that. But they should show her the transcripts. Absolutely.
But if it's not,
but she didn't do anything. She's not a suspect.
But the lawyer can say, if anyone in the case, if it goes criminal, they can say you didn't keep this information confidential. It's now not even admissible in court.
God, I don't know. Yeah.
Done.
But there's probably nothing in there anyway, unless she said somebody's name.
And I can't imagine they'd have a transcript. Like if the police.
Yeah, that's a good point.
How often must they get a call where somebody's acting unusual downtown? I can't imagine they record or write the whole, you know, all the dialogue down. My guess is there's probably like a couple paragraphs of what happened, but right. Either way, it's just the fact that there's the mystery of what's in the report. Like I can't imagine how Shelley must feel knowing that there's a file somewhere in the police station with that written on it, not being able to go in there. I think I'd want to go down there with a baseball bat and make my way in.
When I was listening to that part, I was thinking, man, I hope this doesn't turn into 12 years later and everyone is screaming about, well, why didn't you give this information? And all of these details are getting lost. You know, people should really pay attention to your podcast with this right now, because this is pretty close to, you know, we're talking like 3-4 years later. It's pretty close to the actual disappearance. You're talking actually to the family members about it, and you're not trying to scramble and gather information and dig through a bunch of like, you know, muck to get some progress.
I think that what the case is suffering from now is just the exposure. So I hope that people listening to this show will join the Help Find Emma Philippoff Facebook group. You know, let Shelley know that they care and that they're interested, and you know, and tell people about it, and just get Emma's face and the word out there, because it's hope isn't lost at this point. If Emma is living a transient life somewhere in Canada or the U.S. or wherever she is, you know. That's still very much possible in the short amount of time. And that leads me to the next thing. And I found when I spoke to Shelley, I had asked her, in your search for your daughter, what comes next? And I don't know about you, but I found it absolutely heartbreaking to hear her say she doesn't know what she's going to do next. And she's, you know, feels like she's at a brick wall.
I really thought she was going to respond with a breakdown, like a game plan of what comes next. And she said she has no idea.
Yeah, it's very
heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking.
To hear her put it in words was intense.
And when you think about things in your life that don't really matter, let's say work, or you know, let's just say work, and you have a deadline and you're trying to work towards something and you're at your wit's end. It feels pretty horrible, but you get by it. But to hear someone say that when it's their daughter, like that is just heartbreaking. She has nothing. She has nothing to firmly put her mind and her hands around and say this is going to be where I'm going to go next. She has the Facebook, and she has all of the media outlets that will listen, and she can talk about. But she said even though she's grateful that she gets emails and messages that they saw her 6 months, 8 months, a year ago, as much as she appreciates that, by that time, what does it matter? I can't imagine that.
Someone needs to shake the apple tree, Lance. Jordan, you might be the person to do it. I wish Lance and I could be the people to do it. If we had funding and we were finished with the Maura Murray documentary, I think that this would be a very a wonderful case to dive into and try to help, because
it is so fresh.
It is so fresh, and it seems like there should be more answers. The police that night, to me, seemed like they believed her story based on what I heard in the documentary. It seemed like she was coherent enough and they didn't believe she was a danger to herself. So if we're to believe she killed herself just after that, where's her body? I don't know. I feel like it would have turned up. I could see her having left Victoria, because Victoria, I've actually been to Victoria and Vancouver. Victoria is very small. I can't imagine there are too many people running around homeless, shoeless in November in Victoria. I'm sure there's a number, but not a huge number. But Vancouver has a lot of homeless people. So I could see her having escaped to some kind of transient lifestyle in Vancouver. But a psychotic break or a manic episode does not last for 4 years. It would have ended at some point. She would have contacted somebody.
That's my thought with whether or not there's the transient life, is that the details of the case that would lean towards that is the mental illness, her lifestyle before her disappearance. She was staying with a friend on a boat in a woman's shelter. She was maybe staying at a treehouse for a period of time. So there was some aspects of her life that were pointing in that direction. But the fact that it's been going on for this long without her being arrested or having to go to a hospital and being identified that way, or just, you know, snapping out of it somehow and contacting someone, I don't know. It seems odd. I can't imagine that that's it, but I'm sure it happens, and people, you know, lose a family member for longer than 4 years and they eventually turn up.
I mean, I don't know if it's totally accurate that a psychotic break doesn't last a certain amount of time. If she's not taking medication, and if you're actually looking at the and reading the diary entries, her paranoia is growing and growing and growing. And if you're not taking medication and you're not taking care of it, and you're living on the streets in a transient life, it's getting worse. And it's not like it'll just go away. It's not like, one day it's starting to get a little better.
Well, I think it depends on the illness.
And it depends on your environment too. If you're living a transient lifestyle and you're in the street and you're looking, and in every shadow that you see might be somebody looking back at you, like, that is not helping your illness.
It's not like you're not going to snap out of it. I'm not going to say that, like a cartoon or something like that. But if she was bipolar, for example, she would have, the manic episode would have ended.
Didn't read like bipolar though,
it
did it?
Didn't to me either, but
and
that's
it read
what
like
Shelley.
Paranoia.
Shelley believes it was some kind of mental illness. Did she go into exactly what illness she thought, Jordan?
No, and she did say potentially schizophrenia or some type of mental break. But when I spoke to Shelley on the first episode I did about it, she described reading through Emma's journals, and Emma was referencing things from her earlier in her life and from her childhood that led Shelley to believe that her struggle with mental illness has been going on for a long time. She was said in her teenage years to go for abnormally long walks where she would go on her own and just walk and walk and walk. And I guess that's, I don't know anything about this, but that's
manic walks.
Yeah, like that sort of thing. So maybe it's something that's been building up for a long time, and it just on that day in November when she disappeared was just the day that it, you know, hit its fever pitch.
That is the age that bipolar shows itself. And that's, I think, why I lean towards why I assumed bipolar. Maybe I'm probably wrong in assuming it, but yeah, 24 or something like that, right around that age is when it usually shows itself in a major way.
One other thing. So we talked about the possibility that she could be living a transient life. Getting back to abduction, one thing we didn't talk about, we mentioned Julian, but we didn't talk about the poster guy. I think, I forget what there's different names for him. I've always called him the poster guy, but that was the guy in Vancouver who went into he pulled a missing persons poster off the front of the store and went in the store and complained to the clerk working there, basically saying, this isn't a missing person, it's my girlfriend and she doesn't want to be found. This is a guy in Vancouver. There's stills of him from the security camera in that store, and they're all over the internet, and they were shown in the CBC documentary that we talked about, Finding Emma. But that to me is, I don't know if that's a red herring or what, but that's an odd situation.
Yeah, when I first saw that, I was wow, that's such a, that there's a break right there, right? And then no one would do that. If they in that situation, no one would do that. No one would go in and the store owner notices that you're irritated and he's touching clothing. And by the way, I don't know if they can pull fingerprints off that, or if they tried to pull fingerprints off everything he touched in the store. But he's like just barely looking at the clothes, and he's like, you know, kind of throwing things down. He's like obviously trying to look irritated. And then, I mean, maybe it's just some dude looking for attention, but they were never able to find out who it was later, right?
Never found him, and police said they've wanted to speak to this guy, obviously, but yeah, I guess if that was what was actually happening, why would he go in the store and do that? Especially if those posters were all over town, he'd be fighting an army of people.
Right. Yeah. And what's the use of taking one of those posters down and wobbing it up in your hand and walking into a store and being like, don't mind me, I'm irritated because this is my girlfriend and she just doesn't want to be found, you know, general store owner who I don't know. It
definitely seemed like a red herring to me right off the bat as well. But it's interesting that that guy hasn't turned up and Emma hasn't turned up. If he's probably a drug addict living a transient lifestyle and he hasn't shown up, and I'm not sure exactly when that video footage came out, but you know, he hasn't been found in that time. So maybe there's a chance that Emma could be living a lifestyle similar to that and could have been, his girlfriend. But it's, I think, very, very unlikely. It definitely read like he was just on drugs and,
it actually read to me like maybe a group of his friends were out there and was told him to pull a prank on the store owner.
Yeah, maybe Guy is just an asshole, and that's probably most likely.
Honestly, when I was looking at it after, because at first, like with every one of these types of missing person cases, you see something like that and you lock in and you're, oh, that's a clue. And maybe it is because we've been doing this with the Maura Murray case. Thought that for maybe 20 seconds. And then I was like, no, that guy's an asshole.
Yeah. But at the same time, they should still keep looking for the guy.
Because, oh, I think they are.
Yeah. Yeah. They definitely need to get his story.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Yeah. I mean, this is just like us talking about this guy being an asshole. If I was a police officer, I would hope that I would say, yeah, he's an asshole, but I'm going to find out and make sure that he's an asshole and doesn't know where she is.
Yeah. And again, for Shelly to have that needing to be crossed off the list.
Exactly.
Absolutely. I mentioned there's the Help Find Emma Philippoff Facebook group. There's a community of people that are supporting Shelly, trying to gain exposure for the case and try to stimulate any leads. You've both done such an incredible job stimulating activity in Maura Murray's case. Do you have any advice for people searching for Emma and the people working with Shelly?
I think the only bit of advice that I would have is to not pigeonhole yourself into one particular theory and fight hard for that to be true. One of our listeners who was a police officer said you have to approach any criminal investigation as a mansion with a lot of doors. And you have to look inside every single one of those doors and don't close them until you know that you can rule that out. So open-mindedness. For example, we just talked about that gentleman who went into the store with the wobbed up poster. Know that there are assholes out there and know that there, you know, that could be an actual lead, but follow it up until it eliminate things until the only thing left is something you can't eliminate.
I think the first thing to do would really be to publicize it as much as you possibly can. Shake the tree. That's what we've been doing and seeing the progress, seeing the apples fall. A will lead to B, usually in unexpected ways, though. I would also say this guy, Julian,
And I think even just having the story out there to sink its teeth into people and get them interested in the case and get them to look at pictures of Emma and know the story and know where she may be, there's definitely value in that. And I'm sure you see the results of that, where you're talking about shaking the trees and seeing some apples coming down, because you're making progress in Maura's case just by, you know, telling the story to everybody. Now, before we wrap it up, I would like to ask you both, what's coming next with Missing Maura Murray? I've been watching your photos on Twitter. I'm very excited about your next episode, which, the way the kids say it, it drops tomorrow. What comes next with your show and the documentary?
Well, that episode will probably be out by the time this goes out, I believe. So it is Witness A, who is really the biggest interview probably for me and Lance that we could probably get right now, because her account is so conflicting with the police report and really almost every other report out there. If what she says is true, and you know, we met her, there's really no reason not to believe this woman.
I wouldn't use the word conflicting. I would say her account fits in with a particular timeline and has not been included in any sort of police logs on that night.
Yeah.
Because it's not conflicting. I don't want to confuse it. It's not conflicting. When we went through the process with her, it fits a timeline. The only thing that's conflicting is that she's never been able to talk about it.
How about the documentary? How's progress going on that?
It's going great. We had a great weekend up there in New Hampshire last weekend, and we went to the UMass cabin, and we've got an episode, a podcast episode of that coming out probably next, if you're hearing this when this episode comes out. That footage will be pretty interesting in the documentary as well. So we do have a few more podcasts on deck, if you will, episodes on deck. The documentary is definitely moving forward with great momentum at this point, I'd say.
That will conclude tonight's episode of the Nighttime Podcast. If you're interested in hearing more content, you may be interested in joining the Nighttime Patron Group, where for $1 a month, you'll have access to a monthly bonus episode. You can join the group by visiting patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. That's patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. With that said, on behalf of myself and the show's listeners, I'd like to thank the continued support of the show's current supporters and welcome the newest members to the group, Sean, Jennifer, Diane, Raven, and Jim. In addition to providing me pride and motivation, without you, the production of this show would be impossible. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Nighttime Podcast. If you enjoy your time here, please rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes. To stay up to date with the show, please follow me at facebook.com/nighttimepodcast. And on Twitter, my handle is @nighttimepod. If you have any story ideas or feedback for the show, I always enjoy hearing from you at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.